Thanks, Yellow Magic Orchestra, for leading us in.
Oh, boy.
It was a little hopping for the talking show.
Big boy.
Welcome, listeners. You are listening to K Chong Radio, Chinatown's
only
micro-broadcasting radio station. My name is Nicholas Miller, and I'm here, as always, with the truly inimitable Steven
Kato. Oh, thank you.
Kato.
You know what I heard? I heard it was actually... The C in Kaichung is actually a soft C. Kaichung.
Kaichung. Huh.
I don't know. Is you didn't hear that?
Well, you know, now that I'm a landlord here in Chinatown, with landlord superiors.
Yeah.
The name of the building that I am lord over.
Yeah.
That I have dominion over. Is the Cao Kong Benevolent Association building. And I learned that that's pronounced like a G.
Cao Kong.
Cao Kong.
You know?
Yeah. So I guess, you know, if we are in Chinatown and this is a Chinese radio station, that'd be... Kaichung would be pretty hard to pronounce.
Yeah.
Kaichung.
Kaichung.
Kaichung. Kaichung.
Kaichung.
Kaichung.
Yeah, what's new with you?
Well, we've already talked about this, but I'm still glowing, basking in my mastery of the fine arts.
Yeah, it must feel good.
It feels pretty good. But for me, it's just been like a huge, like the entree off my plate. Because I'm pretty much doing the same thing I was doing during school, minus having to drive to Irvine.
Yeah.
Several days a week.
Yeah. Real time saver.
Was a drag. That was a drag.
Yeah.
Driving there all the time.
Yeah. Of course.
So, you know, I went to a Beckett play this evening.
Oh, wow.
Cool tour. Performance of Happy Days.
Was it good?
It was fantastic.
And it was at UCLA?
I was confused. It was at the Mark Taper Theater, which I think is funded by UCLA or something.
Uh-huh. But where is it?
That's
downtown.
Next to the opera.
Yeah.
So, it kind of like Red Cat.
Yeah.
It's not at CalArts.
It's not.
It's true. Yeah, it's downtown.
It's downtown.
So I was very happy. Also, I was invited by a friend who lives in the Pacific Palisades, so I just assumed...
You were going to the distant west.
Yeah, the gravitas of that part of town and its relationship to something like
cool
theater.
Yeah,
would draw me over. But no, right here in DTLA.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's been there for a while, too, which is crazy.
It's a beautiful...
It's just been right over there.
It's a beautiful... The restrooms are amazing. They smell like cinnamon, and it's all marble.
I love a marble restroom.
Yeah, also they have very tall, thin trash cans next to each hand washing station.
Oh!
Really hot.
Love that.
Yeah.
I am...
You can buy beer and bring it into the theater.
Oh, wow, that's even better.
That's pretty advanced culturally for America.
Yeah, that's rare. That's like the whole reason why people go to Las Vegas, is so they can take a beer from one place to another place.
Or like Amsterdam.
Yeah, you're an American, you go to Europe, and you're like, this is so amazing because I took the beer from here and put it over there.
They let you have beer in any of the spaces over here.
I know.
So that's
like beer is as naughty as you can get in America. That idea that like a grown adult man who's able to buy literally like a trunkload of beer if he wants to feels that...
Assault rifles?
Yeah, assault rifles. All the shit feels that like being able to transport an open beer around equals like some sort of...
Death.
Yeah, or like some sort of transgressive pleasure can be had from doing something like that. Whereas like literally that's just called like... coming home from your job in Germany.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Where your job is to carry around open beers.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been to Berlin. That's
what it seems like
most people
that's
do.
That's literally... Yeah. People usually have two jobs in Berlin. You have a morning job where you hold a latte, and you have
and
an afternoon job. Yeah, and then the afternoon job starts with an inaugural sausage, and then you carry a beer around for the entire afternoon. And then once you finish the beer, you put it down in a can... And you're done for the day.
You know, like as an American, that sounds like two really great jobs. Like they don't even sound like jobs we should be remunerated by any currency.
But it's really
tough. I've been to Berlin, and so many of these people, it's so stressful. They have lost a sizable chunk of their hair.
Yeah,
it's like they just one side
the whole
is
part
gone,
just goes away.
Yeah, because of the enormous stresses from these two jobs.
Uh huh. Yeah, I can believe it.
So
that and your grandfather being a Nazi and having to try and explain that's why you're against. Pro-Palestinian boycotts.
And
because
full heads of hair.
Yeah.
It's a tough situation over there.
I wouldn't want to be in their shoes.
No, but stepping back to the extreme level of culture here at the Mark Taper Theater, get this. So they rang the bell.
Ding dong.
Saying like, okay, it's time.
Yeah, get back in here.
Getting into the seats. And my friend Ava and I, we got in line to get a beer just then. There were like 10 people in line. I thought, well, like,
how's this going
to
work out?
Yeah, this is America. They're just going to shut the doors when the plane needs to leave. And then we paid whatever we paid to not see Beckett. But get this, I asked the person, the person standing there in the uniform, and she said, oh, no, we'll wait till everyone gets their drinks, and then we'll start the play.
Wow.
And
USA.
Not only this, I got the beer and asked if I could bring it in. She said yes. And she said, also, would you like to order a beer now for the intermission? So you don't have to wait in line. And I said, yeah, but how do I know?
Which one's mine?
Yeah. She said, well, we line up all the pre-order drinks on the shelf here, and we put a little card there with your name on it.
Holy shit.
And then I went out there, and there was a beer there waiting for me with my name on it, and no one else had taken it.
Like, because you were just about to, like, grab, like, Susan Sarandon's beer and say, like, it's me, Susan Sarandon.
Yeah, her Chardonnay.
Yeah.
But, you know.
She actually gets a Diane Keaton with the ice cubes in the Chardonnay. Yeah.
The guy before me ordered 3 double shots of Chardonnay.
Double shots?
Yeah, that's how he ordered it.
And shots?
The Chardonnay was $20 a shot. So that was like...
Are you kidding?
Yeah, I was like, well, this guy's bawling out of control with the Mark Taper. He's got $120 worth of Chardonnay.
Wait.
Going to see his Samuel Beckett
shots.
Play.
And they were actually shots.
I think he meant 2 glasses, because, you know, they normally fill the whole, like, volume of the wine glass is only half full.
Right.
And he wanted this... I mean, the first act was 60 minutes. So I think he thought, I can... My friends and I, or maybe he did all 3. That's unclear. But whoever he was concerned about could drink a lot in 60 minutes.
I mean, I know I. It's Beckett.
Yep.
It'll make you want to drink, probably.
Yeah, that guy must have drank a lot.
Happy Days is a one-woman show, right?
Yeah, it's one woman. There is a male actor in it, but he doesn't really speak.
Have a speaking role, yeah.
He speaks a little bit, but more kind of grunts a lot.
Yeah.
And grabs his head quite a bit.
Yeah. Eli Diner saw this and said it was really great.
It was great. It's really great.
Oh, well. Yeah. I hope to go. I saw a Meredith...
It's only up through this weekend, I think.
Shit. I saw the Meredith Monk opera that had been remounted.
Oh, wow.
It was a real stinker. I mean, the music was cool, but it was like, now Meredith Monk finally has a Vegas show. It was stupid. It turned like her unique
Penn and Teller and Monk.
Yeah, seriously. It turned her, you know, really cool, really physicalized singing techniques into just sort of stunts. You know, it's like what Blue Man Group did to Einstein to Neubauten is what Yuval Sharon did to Meredith Monk.
Oh, well, you know.
It was shameful.
Maybe she's got child support.
You know, I think, to be fair, she needs the money, and I don't begrudge her any of that.
Yep.
But I do regret that. Well, you know, here's the positive thing: she actually is asking for money on her website to properly digitally archive her materials.
Okay. For posterity.
Well, I think there's a lot of, for example, the original performance of Atlas, all the documentation of that.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be great if. By having this overly spectacular performance of Atlas mounted here, that draws attention to her work, to some vapid rich person who loves Cirque du Soleil, and that they pump money into Meredith Monk so that way we could actually watch a video of the original performance of Atlas, which seems pretty nice.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe
trickle
something
down
good
economics.
Yeah, my only hope is that this leads to better outcomes from more of Meredith Monk's work.
Hmm.
But anyway, this is a lot of Meredith talk going on.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great segue into our guest tonight. She's flown all the way out here on a private jet from New York City.
Is it her jet?
Is
it a company
not
jet?
Entirely transparent about who she works for other than the New York University.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it's...
And Google. Works for Google.
She said not to say that.
Okay.
Come on.
Sorry.
Okay. So we'll redact that in post.
Sorry.
Here we go. This evening we have the wonderful Meredith Whitaker.
Hello. everyone. Today I am talking about data genesis, the primordial soup from which is made AI. I'm going to go over this and talk a little bit about why does it matter to examine the data closely, and what are the implications of such examinations. This reflects an ongoing research effort at the AI Now Research Institute that I co-founded with Kate Crawford. This is really a collaboration. So this is between myself, Dylan Reisman, Kate, in addition to an interdisciplinary data genesis working group who sort of meets and thinks with us and talks about these issues. So as ever, so much credit to all the brilliant people behind me whose influence is all over this talk. So before I begin on that, let me introduce myself a little bit. I'm the co-founder, co-director of AI Now, at NYU, and I've also worked at Google for over 12 years founding their open research group. So I've been around tech for a while. And to back up a bit, in 2008, I co-founded an effort called MLab, or Measurement Lab, which at the time seemed like a pretty straightforward solution to a very hot problem, right? Net neutrality was a big concern, and everyone wanted to know, was the net neutral? So, of course, to know such a thing, we needed data. How else could we detect neutral versus interested internet performance? So myself and the MLab team set up infrastructure and deployed measurement tests to collect data. Then fast forward 10 years, MLab now provides the largest open network measurement data set on the globe with over 2 petabytes of publicly available data collected from well over 1 million daily speed tests. It influenced the net neutrality order at the FCC that has now been basically overturned. So, you know, success, right? Or kinda, because not surprising to this audience, the road from a proof of concept running on 3 servers to a global network performance benchmark was rocky. It was full of twine and duct tape and the need to make a lot of decisions about what was and wasn't important. What became increasingly clear as a part of this process was that the effort to create meaningful data and the choices we made in the process of creating this data were fundamentally political. ISP lobbyists, big content providers, aspiring platform monopolies, activists, paid experts, etc., all vied in good faith and in bad to advance the validity of their data and the shortcomings of others' methods. So suffice it to say, I was part of a power struggle around classification. Who got to determine what data means, and thus who got to guide the objective and empirical understanding of a much larger set of social concerns. Now, I tell you this because I'm not going to, you know, not because I want to talk about net neutrality at length, but because this experience profoundly shaped my view of AI. For me, it was around 2012 at Google that I began to notice this turn toward AI. There was a lot of buzz. Linked GPUs combined with industrial data were proving the power of deep neural nets. Suddenly, Google Brain could find cat videos. This was incredibly important, and humankind must adapt. The big players were racing to acquire AI startups and talent, and along the way, they were pulling AI researchers out of their labs and offering them LeBron James salaries. So the winter was definitely over, and suddenly, there was nothing AI couldn't do. So in the process of this, a formerly niche academic field, kind of at the sidelines of computer science at that point, was thrust into the limelight. What had recently been theoretical approaches to hypothetical problems were being asked to address an array of social and political concerns, from better healthcare to more efficient criminal justice to personalized education to autonomous vehicles and on and on. AI is everywhere, coursing through the nervous system of our social and economic institutions. Now, of course, AI only knows what's in the data it's trained on. However advanced the algorithm, however fancy, there is no escaping this. AI's worldview reflects the data. So a question that surfaced for many of us was why we were suddenly willing to trust data sets that we knew to be clumsy, inconsistent, and limited to represent our complex social and political world. I think this question has only become more urgent. And it's what we really formed the Data Genesis Project to explore. What is at the foundation of artificial intelligence, and what can we deduce from that? So let's do it. Let's explore. And to set the tone, I'm going to start with 3 hypothetical vignettes showcasing some plausible examples of AI development in action. Now, while these are fictional, they're very familiar to some of us. I paint from life. So meet Maya. Maya is a developer at an AI hiring startup. She needs a comprehensive source of word embeddings to use for an automated resume screening system. It's late. She meets with her manager for a performance review tomorrow. So a quick Google search takes her to Stanford's Natural Language Processing Group homepage, where she finds the GloVe dataset mapping words to vectors. Awesome. However, neither the Google search nor the Stanford homepage expose important research from Arvind Narayanan, Joanna Bryson, Adam Kalai, and others that show significant gender bias in such datasets. Maya uses GloVe unaware. And several months later, her work is integrated into their hiring platform, which the sales department is now pitching as 70% more efficient than human resume review. Meet Tamashi. Tamashi is building an ML system to classify shoes by style and brand as part of her undergraduate thesis. And first, she needs data, of course. So she develops a script that searches Amazon for shoe categories, then collects the matching product images, and poof. And she's also generous, so once she's done, she shares a Dropbox link of the data set. Now, given the scramble to make AI and the relative scarcity of data, her data set is downloaded 60 times in the first 2 days and added to a number of public data set libraries. However, what Tamashi didn't realize at the time is that her script broke down mid-job after only visiting the men's shoe category, see here. So while she reruns her script in time for the paper deadline, she doesn't remember to update the shared data set, which remains unchanged. Now, finally, meet a team of university researchers. They want to build an AI system with a social impact. This is pretty trendy right now. So being the type of young people who believe in law and order, they design a partially generative neural net meant to detect gang membership. What could go wrong? They use the LAPD crime data and regional gang databases, and they train and test their system and submit a conference paper. But at no point do they think to examine the data they're using, or the significant work that documents racial bias in risk scoring and predictive policing systems. Nor do they realize, although this too is documented, that gang databases are notoriously shoddy. In one example, the Cal Gang database listed toddlers, while a full 23% of people in the database had no recorded connection to gangs. Actually, I'm just kidding. That last example is real. That is not fictional. The paper was presented earlier this year and received significant criticism that seemed to catch the researchers off guard. And I would note that if they'd been in a corporate setting, this criticism might not have surfaced until after the product was deployed, if at all. So what on earth is going on here? What I see is a kind of whiplash. You go back 15 years, and edge detection was a moderately hard problem in machine vision. Now object recognition is staggeringly good, and along with other AI techniques, it's being asked to make increasingly sensitive determinations across core social domains. But why is this happening now? AI is certainly not a new field. It's over 60 years old. But in the last 5 to 10 years, we can all attest, it's newly everywhere. And if we think about it, this shouldn't surprise us, because when we examine what it takes to actually make AI at scale, soup to nuts, it's no coincidence that the rise of AI accompanied the consolidation of the tech industry. Indeed, AI as we think of it now is predicated on industrial resources and infrastructure. You need massive amounts of data, you need the market reach to continuously collect such data, you need vast computational power, and you need the ability to recruit and retain those LeBron James AI research talent, right? And right now, by my estimates, only 7 or so companies in the world have these things together. Without them, the major leaps in the field from DeepFace to AlphaGo would not have been possible. You know, they wouldn't even been imaginable, really. So the tech has accelerated on the back of massive industrial resources and a drive for commercialization. But while this has happened, the practices of AI research and development haven't kept pace. Conferences still reward the same type of work, and startups and tech companies still have the same pressure to launch and iterate and turn a profit. And still, all too often, the data is taken on faith. Now, this should not be confused with a lack of awareness or concern. I'm willing to bet that your news feeds are algorithmically determined to be fairly similar to mine, and that they confirm that AI bias is a very hot topic. Indeed, in the last year, we saw top tech executives like John Giandrea at Google, Mustafa Suleiman at DeepMind and Satya Nadella at Microsoft publicly emphasizing the importance of this problem. So we do have a growing awareness, and that is excellent. But again, the practices on the ground accounting for these problems are lagging far behind, even as AI races forward. The question then is, how do we change this, given that the plane is off the ground? Is it possible to build while examining and fixing the foundation we're building on, and what would a fix even look like? So with these in mind, let's now turn to this foundation and examine some popular data sets used for training and benchmarking in the AI field. We'll start with a classic, some of you may be familiar, labeled Faces in the Wild is, of course, a canonical benchmarking data set for facial recognition. It contains over 13,000 labeled images of faces, and along with ImageNet, it played a huge part in the recent AI boom. It served as the standard against which a battle to dominate facial recognition and machine vision was waged. So who could perform better? Was a big question on everyone's mind, and across the industry, improving performance against labeled faces in the wild became an assertion of ML dominance, machine learning dominance, and a really good way to woo top talent. Now, labeled faces in the wild was created in 2007, notably before AI hit the big time. Its authors, Eric Learned Miller and his team, wanted to help solve a current hard problem in facial recognition. How do we detect faces in uncontrolled environments where lighting, angle, and context vary? This was relevant because the standard data set at the time was the Yale face data set here, which looks more like a collection of new wave mugshots than a photo album. So the labeled faces team turned to the material they had available, a common story. They used Faces in the Wild. This is an older, poorly labeled data set of images scraped from Yahoo News between 2002 and 2004. They cleaned it, they labeled it, and Labeled Faces in the Wild was born, offering a vast compendium of celebrities, power players, and the newsworthy in the early 2000s. Now, given its source and the U.S. media landscape at the time, the representation across race and gender is in no way surprising. According to Han and Jane, Labeled Faces in the Wild is 77.5% male, 83.5% white, 8.47% black, and just over 8% Asian. It contains almost no children and almost no elderly people. So suffice it to say, this does not represent the general population now or at the time. Questions of representation like this are really important, and they need to be asked more frequently. But they're not all we should ask of our data. We should also look at how people are represented and at the infrastructures of representation. Here we have two photos that I borrowed from Josh Lovejoy's essay, Fair is Not the Default. These date from the 1970s. Both are taken with Kodak film, and both show lackluster brown colors. Now, why is this? Well, Kodak used white women as their benchmark, standardizing their color processing to ensure white skin tones were well represented without considering others. Indeed, it wasn't until 1995 that the company finally bowed to pressure from, can anyone guess? It was the chocolate and furniture manufacturers, and corrected their color processing. So we should also note that similar standards were used in the movie industry, something that historian Richard Dyer documents thoroughly. So we have here a clear example of the way the U.S.'s history of racial discrimination is embedded in the very material that makes our data. And in examining the Labeled Faces data set, we might want to ask whether the film stock used by news photographers in the early 2000s was standardized to reflect all skin tones. We might also ask about standard camera equipment, lighting protocols for celebrity photo shoots, and common photo processing techniques, among a number of other questions. And answering these questions could help explain subtle differences not recognizable to the human eye, among other things. It's likely this is more important than some think, because a recent spate of adversarial research out of MIT, Google, and elsewhere has demonstrated just how sensitive advanced AI systems are to subtle, seemingly undetectable patterns and distinctions that can nonetheless lead to significant errors in classification. Now, Labeled Faces in the Wild is a benchmarking data set. It's not something you typically use to train a production model. Why is this important then? Well, because of course, like the Kodak and the white woman, the standards we use to measure success matter a lot. MIT PhD candidate Joy Bulamwini and machine vision researcher Timnit Gebru made this case very clearly. They recently published research that tested pre-trained face recognition APIs from IBM, Microsoft, and Face++. They looked at these systems' ability to recognize faces in a diverse data set that included both dark-skinned and light-skinned people across two genders. And their results were stark. Not only did all of the systems perform significantly better on men than on women, but all of the models performed worst on dark-skinned women. Indeed, IBM's system was 34% more effective on pale men than on dark-skinned women. So we can see here how such standards shape our sense of progress and define the very narrow bounds of so-called innovation. We can also see that with labeled face in the wilds of the arbiter, winning the machine vision race meant simply being very good at recognizing pale male faces, to use Joy's description. So while there's much more to discuss when it comes to facial recognition, like why on earth would we want it to begin with, this example is clearly very concerning. Now, given what we've just seen here, we might wonder, okay, so why don't we just change the benchmark? Well, here we have an image of one of the 6 international prototype kilograms. This is stored in Paris at the International Bureau of Weights and Measures in a temperature-controlled vault requiring 3 independently controlled keys to enter. Why such a big deal? Because these precisely constructed prototype kilograms are the final arbiter on which the global metric system relies. If they change, a whole socio-technical system built around them would have to change too. Now, of course, AI benchmarking datasets are not the prototype kilogram, but there are similarities. As with the kilogram, a broader set of norms and practices are built around these datasets. Careers are made, incentives are set, questions are raised and dropped, and along the way, the field is shaped. Now, I should be clear, this is not to say that change is not possible or desirable, but to bring into focus the complex implications of such a change. With these issues in mind, let's look at another benchmark. Google released the Atomic Visual Actions Dataset, or AVA, last year. It offers 192 15-minute movie clips in which consecutive human actions are labeled. The paper that accompanied this dataset explains that movies were chosen because they represented lifelike activity. That movies contain, quote, unfolding sequences of human actions somewhat representative of reality as conveyed by competent actors. Well, browsing through this dataset, you very quickly notice patterns in that seemingly lifelike reality. For instance, here you have the category playing with kids. Now, not a man to be seen in a lot of what looks like soft focus camera work. But don't worry, MRA dudes, I see you. If you want men, you got men. They are in the kick a person category right here. So let's dig a bit here. Because a few months before the AVA dataset was published, another part of Google was collaborating with the Gina Davis Institute. It was using machine learning to analyze gender disparity in film. They looked at the 100 highest grossing U.S. films between 2014 and 2016 and found that, no surprise, with the exception of the horror genre, men are shown and heard nearly twice as much as women. And this spread increases significantly in Oscar-winning films, LOL. Now, of course, these findings came during the same year that systemic abuse and harassment by industry gatekeepers like Harvey Weinstein was revealed, who, we should remember, founded Miramax, a production company famous for their consistent man-filled Oscar wins. This is all important. But in addition to who is included and excluded and why, we should also ask what is shown and what is left out and why that. Now, to begin this, we could start by asking whether any of AVA's source movies were produced in the U.S. between 1940 and 1968. This was the time when the Motion Picture Production Code, also known as the Hays Code, dictated what could and could not be pictured in U.S. film. Sex was definitely out, among many other fun things. So, not surprisingly, these prohibitions led immediately to ways to get around them, to ways of representing or hinting at the forbidden image. Famously, the cigarette became a potent symbol for sexual intimacy. So when we watch the extremely excellent 1940 film Now Voyager, pictured here, what's being represented in this famous scene is more than two people smoking. It represents an absence that could not be captured on screen. In examining AVA, then, we need to look at the norms of representation and how these shape what is shown and what isn't. And we need to ask what possible realities this might model. Of course, there are also some basic questions. What were the available resources? What were the selection methods? And what were the constraints? In this case, we know that a team in Google's machine perception research group used content available on YouTube, which automatically limits their selection to what's hosted there. We can also assume that their selection was further limited to clips that Google was able to license as a part of a publicly available data set. We also know that click workers were hired to label the clips and to generate a final set of action classifications. Now, this adds a further factor to consider. Click workers are essential infrastructure for machine learning, doing the repetitive and low-paid job of labeling and cleaning data. Without this precarious labor, machine learning does not work. It would not exist, which means that these hidden workers are often the arbiters of what data means, and they often shape the epistemic undergirding of AI, even as their work is rarely acknowledged and very poorly compensated. So, to my knowledge, there has yet to be any research looking at distinctions in labeling between click workers from different demographics and geographies. And, you know, there probably should be, because recent research from Lily Irani, Joel Ross, and others shows a significant demographic shift in the profession. 5 years ago, click workers could be characterized as middle-class, U.S.-based workforce. Now that's changed to a more international cohort with a large population of well-educated Indian workers. Now, as I mentioned, we don't know whether this shift has any impact on data, but it certainly could. And in the case of AVA, we don't know who they contracted to do this work, nor do we know the instructions given to the workers and how this may have framed their understanding of the task. But given the fundamental role click workers play, these are questions we should be asking, in addition to questions around labor and recognition. Now, I'm sorry to tell you, but it gets even messier than this, because not all data sets are as clearly delineated as Labeled Faces in the Wild or AVA. Consider the Penn Tree Bank. This is a hodgepodge corpus of English text used in natural language processing to train AI systems to recognize and predict words. It's a standard in the field, the Penn Tree Bank is, and it includes the Wall Street Journal articles from the 1980s, Department of Energy abstracts, Federal News Service stories of terrorist activity in South America, in addition to a number of full books, including the classics Who Rules the Marriage Bed and New Directions in Parapsychology. Now, that's definitely a lot of random text, or maybe it's not so much. Because what you wouldn't know if you weren't a member of the NLP natural language processing community is that almost no one uses the whole data set. Indeed, they usually only use the Wall Street Journal part. As Hannah Wallach, a senior machine learning researcher at Microsoft Research, put it, it's likely many researchers don't even know the rest of the data set exists. And this more or less undocumented norm is the kind of thing we need to watch for in our attempt to understand the role data plays in shaping AI. How it's used is just as important as what it is. And in this case, what it is an English language business newspaper with a noted conservative bent and a readership dominated by fairly wealthy men that's serving as the standard by which natural language processing's grasp of written English is measured. We can begin to understand this very specific form of Wall Street Journal English by looking at the Wall Street Journal style guide. It was written in 1981, and it dedicates a page and a half on precisely how to report on bankruptcy while advising against using the word ain't without quotation marks. Now, by comparison, here's a text message that is supposedly between millennials. I'm not one, I wouldn't know. but, you know, we can see the issue immediately. What would natural language processing trained on an old Wall Street Journal make of this? Which is a funny and a serious question, because as sociolinguists like Deanna Hoke have documented, complex and subtle grammars have developed around texting. We can all kind of feel this when we text, right? These grammars serve to communicate tone, to communicate humor and intent, a period after a word, using shorthand, using correct grammar or ignoring it. These can all carry significant meaning. And this meaning changes and evolves, and it often differs between subgroups. So, obviously, old Wall Street journals won't cut it here. But there's a bigger question. What would cut it? How can you settle on a universal definition of what language and grammar mean when faced with a diverse and dynamic communication landscape? How do you choose which or whose norms to include and which to ignore? Now, let's make these questions even harder, and let's turn to sentiment analysis. Now, sentiment analysis looks to understand not just the meaning and order of written language, but actually interpret its tone and its feeling. How would you do that? How would you map something as subjective and contextual as sentiment to something as variable and contextually specific as written language, one might ask? Well, where there's a way, a will, where there is a will and the possibility of VC funding, there is definitely a way. One popular data set for training sentiment analysis classifiers is IMDb, the world's largest crowdsourced movie rating site. We can see the logic here. The format presents a ready-made correlation. The sentiment from 1 to 5 stars corresponds to the text of the written review. And there you have it, the feeling behind the language solved. Of course, not really. Because contributing to IMDb, like many crowdsourced ratings sites, does not appeal to everyone. To get tautological, IMDb reviews are written by people who like to write free reviews on the internet. And I guess maybe it's not surprising that these happen to be mostly men. Indeed, according to 538, for 90% of movies, rankings from men outnumber those from women 2-1. Now, here we have two reviews of the woman-led remake of Ghostbusters, which received extremely low, angry IMDb ratings from, we say, think, mainly men. Now, if we were to do just a very clunky mapping of text to sentiment, terms like ex-wife, woman, and feminist would all fall in the extremely negative category, given their correlation with a 1-star review. How would you solve this problem? More diverse reviews could potentially help, or I think not, because language works in many ways, and of course its meaning is dependent on context. A mobile phone may receive a 5-star rating for being smaller than expected, while a smaller than expected diamond would likely receive 1 star. But hold your horses, we're not done. We have a similar conundrum in machine vision. Like sentiment analysis for text, affect analysis offers to tell you what someone is really feeling or what they're really like based on their image or video. Of course, the inability to objectively know the interior life of another person has occupied philosophers, poets, friends, and lovers throughout history. But never fear, affect analysis or emotion AI companies like Affectiva promise to solve this age-old problem. How? Well, according to their website, first they carefully label over 60,000 human face videos according to the facial analysis coding system, which classifies facial expression into over 5,000 separate micro-movements. Now, once the faces are labeled by micro-movement, they are then classified based on their proximity to the 7 core emotions. Today I learned there are only 7. Now, the justification for this approach relies heavily on work by Paul Ekman, a psychologist who in the early 70s claimed to prove the existence of inherent and universal emotional expressions that were the same across all bodies and all cultures, an essentialist to be sure. When we head to the archives, we see that, not surprisingly again, Ekman's claims faced significant criticism at the time. I think Margaret Mead yelled him down once. And that the methods by which he supposedly proved universal emotional expression, which is so important, so foundational to affect analysis, were extremely flimsy. A brief detour should help illustrate. At the beginning of the 20th century, filmmaker Lev Kuleshov did an experiment. He edited 3 video sequences, each sequence beginning with the same neutral face of a man seen here. The first sequence cut from a man to the image of a dead body. The second from the man to an image of soup. And the third from the man to a woman. When these sequences were shown, the audience reportedly raved about the acting, believing, depending on the sequence they'd seen, that the man was expressing grief, hunger, or desire. So, no surprise, context matters in our interpretation of others' emotional states. And this is where Ekman's research and the claims that rely on it break down thoroughly. In attempting to prove the theory of universal emotions, Ekman, acting ever the colonist, flew to New Guinea, where he contacted a pre-literate group of people. His methods were simple. He told them a story, then showed them pictures of three faces and asked them to select the face that best displayed the emotion relayed in the story. Does this sound familiar? Indeed, because as researcher Lisa Barrett notes, when the experiment is repeated without the leading story, the consensus mapping emotion to a given picture dissolves, as does the intellectual foundation on which such affect analysis is justified. But bear with me, because now we're heading from the fire to the frying pan. I imagine that many of you are familiar with the now infamous GADAR paper from Kaczynski and Wang, which was published last year. They claim to be able to tell a gay person from a straight person based on a photo. To do this, they took images of gay and straight identifying people scraped from U.S. dating sites. They labeled them, then they trained a neural network to find patterns and differences between types of faces. They ignored a lot of things. Their methods were bad. Self-selection, standards of presentation and beauty in the gay and straight communities they sampled, selfie norms, and much, much else. Not to mention some notable statistical problems which have been debated all over the blogs. So suffice it to say, their claims and methods were quickly torn down. But let's be very clear, whether or not it's taken seriously in the field, this work is incredibly dangerous. Being gay is still illegal in 72 countries, and in some, it's punishable by death. So now we reach an uncomfortable edge, if we hadn't already. If this sounds suspiciously like discredited race science and physiognomy, that's because it is. If you recognize a similarity between Kaczynski's logic and the logics of affect and sentiment analysis, that's because there is one. From skewed data, from shaky justifications, we get dangerous and flawed classification systems that present the veneer of scientific credibility. Now, this isn't just buggy or incorrect. It creates norms and standards that those classified by such systems are held to. And the stakes are incredibly high. These norms are shaping lives and our perception of reality as AI systems are implemented throughout social domains. However much we want to de-bias data, whatever clever technical solutions we posit, we still hit a fundamental snag. Data is by its nature reductive. Or, to quote the brilliant Lorraine Dastin, all classification depends on abstraction from the blooming, buzzing world of particulars, accentuating some significant features and muting others. And so, all classification raises issues of power. Whose vision of what is not significant is and is not significant are we adhering to? Who gets to make the determination about what is or is not muted? We need not only ask these questions, but we need to connect them to the late capitalist context of 2018, where, again, around 7 companies are in the position to make these choices for global populations through the AI systems they build and disseminate. Which is a good time to turn to the brilliant Stuart Hall, who reminds us that the power to define what difference means, what difference between people means, and to determine material and cultural status based on such differences is at the root of all oppressive systems. So yes, these are difficult times and these are daunting challenges. And I frankly believe that those of us here have an urgent and significant responsibility. Because while I'm up here talking, AI isn't slowing down. So the question then is, what do we do about it? In closing, I'm going to offer a few incomplete thoughts. First, if I've imparted nothing else, let it be this. Don't trust the data. Be suspicious, be curious, and ask questions. Whose worldview and whose interest shaped it? Don't blithely use a data set without asking, and don't publish work based on data without answering. And be very suspicious of technical systems or database conclusions that don't themselves address these urgent questions. Second, I know, like me, a lot of you have significant privilege. A lot of you are inside big companies or you work with them. And that means that even if you're not the most powerful, you have power. Draw your bright lines. Make these clear to those you're working with. Encourage them to do the same. Demand a say in where and how the technology you contribute to will be used. Reach out to organizations like the Tech Workers Coalition, who are organizing industry employees and allies around such issues. And blow the whistle if you need to. This means taking a risk. And being willing to take a risk is what it means to have skin in the game. Because we all have a responsibility, and those with privilege have the most responsibility. Now, those of you on the outside, of these fancy rooms. Keep pushing. I can testify your voices are heard. Demand radical new forms of governance and be vocal about this. Make it clear that shareholder value cannot be the determining factor in deciding how and for whose benefit these powerful systems are used. And don't accept feel-good PR or vague statements in lieu of a meaningful accountability. Finally, know that this must be a collective and interdisciplinary movement. We can't leave technical AI researchers to do this alone. Indeed, I believe we face grave danger if we continue to frame AI as a technical discipline and trust one narrow set of practices to direct these systems without social and political context and analysis, which means that all of us across disciplines and domain need to have a say. Indeed, one of the things that spurred Kate and I to found AI Now was the shared recognition that we needed a radically new approach to contending with AI, one that involved listening and learning across boundaries, one that importantly centered the voices and experiences of marginalized populations whose oppression is mapped in the data and systems that are now amplifying and entrenching the discriminatory status quo. In closing, thank you so much for being here for this and being receptive to a fairly difficult talk. I believe that this work is urgent and that the time to push back against technocratic dominance is right now. So if you're interested, please reach out to us at AI Now, which we formed with this mission in mind. A new world is possible. Thank you.
I'll never think about AI the same.
I think about AI kind of the same, but I think I agreed to begin with.
Yeah, it's even more surprising that these things need to be said in public venues. But I guess, you know, I'm not involved in technology in that way.
Yeah,
so I don't know the community so well, if you'll even call it that.
Yeah,
but good and bad to know that these people need a lesson.
Yeah, well, I think. From the examples Meredith provided, you can see that the behavior of the tech community alone indicates that the lessons are not are necessary.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is something I like the way that you so concisely put the point that you can't have that you can't get, let the mathesis of the presentation of information. You know, once it's properly quantified and everything like that, just to believe that it therefore is that way,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to analyzing how that quantification came to be performed.
Right.
You know, like, that makes perfect sense. You know,
well,
like...
And it's also an interesting image of structural racism, because I feel like normally the way it gets presented as, like, this enormous other... that is, like, incomprehensible. But it's like, well, actually, the way the data set was collected was racist. Someone mm-hmm. made that decision, maybe unconsciously, but
yeah.
regardless, they did it. And then it gets trickled through in a way that has real effects.
Yeah, and it's not even the same group of people making those decisions. Like,
exactly.
Someone makes a decision at Kodak, and then
right.
farther down the line, images that use that technology
right.
are used for something else.
Yeah. Or even the example of the, like, you know, the person working on their project, and they have a performance review the next day, and so they
yeah.
grab whatever data set they have.
Yeah.
That also seems like a very likely implementation
totally
of structural racism.
Totally reasonable. Yeah.
So in the way...
Something that totally happens.
Yeah, presenting it as, in its particulars, I thought was rather effective.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, I mean, I think the funny part is that, you know... Meredith works for Google, and that somehow I'd be curious to see how she feels about c- clearly having these very strong opinions about, you know, what kind of ethical guidance is necessary in the technological field, but then not in any way seeing that as in conflict with the sort of monopoly scenario. Because if you wanted diverse voices, wouldn't it make more sense for there to be actually diversity in the field?
Yeah.
For example, or commercial diversity, you know, mm-hmm. so that way, you know, you wouldn't be dependent on the decision making of just one company.
Mm-hmm.
But we literally are, you know, and that's a company that employs her as well. So I think that's kind of interesting. Like, what's the, although she, her job is to be critical of the company from inside or whatever.
Well, I think now she works at NYU.
I think she does both.
Yeah, probably. You know, we're all composed of contradictions.
Yeah.
I don't find that
that
part as troubling as maybe you do. But
well, I mean, I guess it's just like with that ownership, with that situation existing, how do you think things will turn out? Like, what would lead you to believe that an ethical critique will find any soil, you know, any oxygen in a context where it really doesn't? Like the example she presents, there's mm-hmm. no reason within that other system for them not to continue. It's not like they're going to get rid of performance reviews, and therefore people will, like, they will have performance reviews.
Or invest in other research methods. I mean, it seems, I don't work in that sector of the tech world, but it seems like perhaps, say she gives this presentation to the directors at Google.
Yeah.
And they part of that role seems to be like a progressive left-leaning person.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, like if you're going to be a Hollywood producer, for the most part, you got to be somewhat left-leaning, I guess.
Like some sort of Democrat. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, otherwise you're just, you know, you're in the wrong crowd.
Okay.
So I've yet to see like a persuasive image of how that stuff actually goes down. Cause it's like the, from the outside, it seems like they're open to this kind of criticism, but then shit doesn't get implemented. So you wonder,
right.
Like, is it like some kind of like misinterpretation of Japanese management style from the 80s where they're just like, okay, we'll put that over here and have these guys work on it, but then have them do something else, or, you know, like,
yeah. Or I mean, the company is also so large that we can put you over here and you can work on it. And so,
yeah, keep working on it. Keep letting us know about how bad we are, like every 6 months.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the thing, there's like,
my therapist says this is actually really good.
Yeah. And
it's really good.
On the other side of the other side of your day planner, you're like, I'm meeting with Stephen Miller about improving baby jails.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, how big data can help baby jails, you know?
The guys from Wayfair are coming over.
Yeah.
And they got some really interesting efficiency ideas about their delivery systems.
Yeah. Exactly this kind of thing, right? So, like...
And that's maybe her point, which isn't new in the history of thought, but that, you know, abstraction can have very pernicious effects.
Totally.
On the social fabric.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I had dinner the other day with a woman who thought that treating homeless people like Amazon packages would be the solution. You know, like, you have to have fully abstracted yourself from the belief that those are other humans.
Well, and not in an ironic way, right?
No.
She thought it was a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, and in an earnest, and, you know, she had done some reasoning on the topic.
Applying her technocratic problem-solving skills.
And her, you know, a multiple degree haver, good schools, smart person, great income.
Ding.
Earning way more money than I ever have in my whole life, probably, every year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, crazy.
What a world.
I think she was even in human resources, actually, in the company.
That's the department she's in.
Yeah.
Because I was like, everyone's been in a show, human resources.
No, but you know, like human, you know, like... That was just like an ironic thing, like human resources, where it's like, they're like the word that just suggests
that
same as like trees in a forest or like oil in the ground.
That would be the exact kind of person who would think of shipping them out.
It'd be the exact kind of person who would name like the personnel department, rename the personnel department the human resources department or something.
Yeah. When I briefly had a corporate job, I sat next to the human resources department and would chat with one of the women who worked there. It was a pretty scary situation.
Like hiring and firing people all the time?
They didn't do that so often. And obviously what they did, they brought security. So that made it scary by virtue of the fact that the people firing you had guns or mallets or something.
Well, they were afraid of what you might do.
Yeah. Which I always anticipated was just like Office Space, like you break the printer or something. But yeah. I guess like guns could get involved. I don't know.
Well, yeah, if people can be armed.
Yeah. Although I don't think they can. And like, can't you, as a business owner, say like you can't have guns at work?
I don't know.
But I guess you can bring guns clandestinely.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
You could definitely buy a gun.
Yeah. She spent most of the time I worked there talking about the enormously expensive wedding she was planning.
Yeah.
And seemed to be having multiple visits to the bank with her husband about the kind of debt financing they were going to take on for the wedding.
Oh, my God.
So I was, yeah.
I was holy shit. Like the crazy part is that you went into debt for your wedding, and then you actually have to live.
Yeah, like it's a relationship with the bank, not with each other.
Don't you want to use your the capital you could get in a loan to get yourselves a house?
We've
or something?
Almost paid off the wedding, and now we're going to start focusing on our first car,
our chocolate lab. Yeah. Oh my God. Wow.
Well, this world's pretty much coming to a close, so we might as well.
Yeah,
for the
just
night.
Draw the curtain. Did you catch the debate today?
I didn't.
Speaking of world coming to an end, well, we'll talk about
Beckett.
It next week.
Yeah,
I suppose that's true.
Yeah. All right. Good morning, Chinatown.
Good night.